I'm just gonna play till everybody gets here. Morning. A beautiful morning indeed. It was a little cooler, I noticed, as I stepped out of my hotel this morning, and that's wonderful. Today is the next installment of this strange hodgepodge of ideas called the Storyteller's Doubts. Today, I'm going to explore with you the question, does language illuminate or obscure? And I look through the repertory of stories that I offer to audiences on the topic of language, and I have one that I hope you'll enjoy. It does not employ, however, a 12-string guitar or a Celtic harp, but rather, it uses a traditional African instrument. This is my sansa. It's also called a thumb piano. You play it with your thumbs. Some people call them kalimbas, but a storyteller friend of mine said, no, they're not really kalimbas. Kalimba is a commercial name of a South African company, white-owned, that took the sansa and marketed them to the world. The story I'm going to offer you comes from Ghana. In Ghana, there's a great civilization called that of the Soninke people. And they were extremely urbane, as you'll detect from this story that I'm about to share with you. This is called A Messenger to Maftam. Once long ago, in Soninke land, there lived a man named Mama D. Mama D was not good looking. Mama D was not a great hunter. Mama D was not rich. And yet, Mama D was famous all across Soninke land. For it was said by the people that this Mama D, no matter what, found it impossible to tell a lie. News of Mama D's fame spread across the land from village to village until it entered the ear of Behene, the great chief of all the Soninke people. Behene did not like the notion that someone amongst his people might be as famous as he was. And so the mighty chief sat on his throne one day and said,
I do not believe that any man, no matter how honest, no matter how clever, finds it impossible to tell a lie. Why would today is truth, by tomorrow, when circumstances change, can become a lie? I think this Mama D is arrogant. I think he is fooling everybody. Bring Mama D to me.
And two tall warriors ran out of the visiting palace, down the grassy slope, across the bridge that swung above the rushing river, and into the forest toward the village where this Mama D reputedly lived. An hour later, they burst into the village, and all the people pointed to the same hut. They ran into the hut and found a bead curtain hanging in the entryway. They pulled it aside. And there, asleep in the middle of the day, was a very slender man. Without a word of explanation, they grabbed Mama D. And they dragged him through the village, through the forest, over the bridge, up the grassy slope, into the visiting palace, and they threw him prostrate on the mats in front of the chief. And Behene looked down and saw Mama D and asked,
"You are Mama D?"
And Mama D, trembling on the mats, looked back up and said,
"Yes."
Mama D, the people say that you, no matter what, find it impossible to tell a lie. Is this true?
Yes.
Yes, but is it not true, Mama D, that what today is a truth, by tomorrow, when circumstances change, can become a lie?
Oh, great Behene, that is indeed true, but nevertheless, I myself find it impossible to tell a lie.
Go.
And the powerful chief let Mama D go. But Behene could not get it out of his thoughts. And he sat on his throne all that day and worried about it and stewed about it until finally, toward the afternoon, he burst out and said,
"I do not believe it. It is impossible for a man, even by accident, never to tell a lie. And if I could, but... wait. Wait."
And Behene had an idea. Next morning, Mama D lay in his hut, when suddenly, the warriors flung aside the bead curtain and grabbed him again. And they dragged him through the forest, over the bridge, up the grassy slope into the visiting palace, and once again, with no ceremony whatsoever, threw him prostrate on the mats before the chief. But this time, Behene looked down and said,
"Good morning, Mama D."
"Good morning."
"Yes, good morning. Mama D, since you are the man who no matter what can never tell a lie, I have a very important mission for you. As you know, my wife, the queen, lives in the village of Mavdam, not very far, 2-3 hours through the forest. You must take a message to her for me. You will become the messenger to Mavdam. Do you understand thus far?"
"Why, yes."
"Good. Do you see my hunters?"
Standing behind Behene were tall hunters, all of whom had long spears, the points of which looked to be pounded silver leaves.
"Why, yes, I see them."
"Yes. My men and I will go hunting today for wood, dear. And we will kill one and bring it to the village of Mavdam, where my wife resides, tomorrow. Just as the sun reaches the top of the sky, we will arrive. Ask my wife to tell her villagers to build plenty of fires and to prepare plenty of bowls of milk beer for me and my men. Do you understand the message, Mama D?"
Why, yes."
"Good. Go."
And so with the message in his mind, out of the village ran Mama D, the man who could not tell a lie. Well, an hour went by, but Behene made no motion to rise and go hunting for wood deer. Another hour elapsed, and still the chief simply sat there with a smile on his face. Finally, one of the warriors whispered into his ear, and Behene said,
"Wait. We are not going hunting at all. And we will not arrive at the village of Mavdam tomorrow when the sun reaches the top of the sky. But Mama D will tell my wife this. It will not come to pass. And he will have lied. And I will have him punished." So, sit.
Meanwhile, running through the forest, Mama D at last trotted into the village of Mavdam. He went immediately to the visiting palace, where he prostrated himself on the mats before the queen. She sat in her throne with cascades of colorful cowrie shell necklaces down her breast. And he looked up and said,
"Oh, great queen, I bring you a message from your husband, Behene the chief."
She looked at him.
"Well, what is it?" "Well, your husband, he intends to go hunting. Now, as often as not, intentions are not followed through upon, but nevertheless, he indicated to me that he intended to go hunting. Now, if he follows through on his intention and he goes hunting, he might catch a wood deer. But then again, one goes into the forest, one never knows one will catch or be caught by. Perhaps a lion will eat him and an elephant will step on him, in case he won't come to the village of Maptam at all. But if he does follow through on his intention, and if he were to catch something, it might be a wood deer, and he might come here tomorrow when the sun reaches the top of the sky. And it's a little hard to know what the top of the sky is, you know, a little bit over there, a little bit over there. I'm sure it's out there somewhere. But nevertheless, if he does come, he might want to have plenty of fires burning. Now, if he doesn't catch a wood deer, he won't need to cook it. It is rather warm, one never knows. And you might want to have lots of bowls of milk beer. Now, if he doesn't catch a wood deer, he'll really be disappointed. He'll really want some milk beer. I'm not really sure. One never knows, but that's my message.
The queen looked down at him.
What? But that is my message.
Well, thank you. You may go.
And Mamadi immediately went to the visitor's hut, where he promptly fell asleep. And the next morning, long before the sun reached the top of the sky, even as it flamed in the treetops, into the village strode Behene with all his warriors. He went immediately to his wife's palace and said to her,
"Good morning, my wife."
"Good morning, husband."
"Did the messenger I sent yesterday arrive?"
"He did."
"And he is still here?"
"Oh, he's in the visitor's hut."
He turned to his men. "Go get him, go get him." And the two warriors ran across the village, threw aside the bead curtain, and
they dragged Mamadi into the palace and threw him prostrate on the mats in front of both Behene and the queen.
"Is this the messenger?"
"That is the messenger."
"Did he not say that I would hunt a wood deer and bring it here today as the sun reached the top of the sky and to have plenty of fires burning and lots of bowls of milk beer?"
"He did."
"Ha ha! He lied. That did not happen. You lied. Pick him up, man."
"Yes."
"But husband, go ahead, man. Pick him up. But husband, man.
Husband!"
"What?"
"Well, he said you might do those things, but he put so many twists and turns upon his words, he never really said you'd do any of them at all."
"What?" "Yes, but my..." "Mama D, rise. You are indeed a clever man. And it looks as if today it is Behene who is the big fool. Only for today. So, hunters, go out into the forest, kill a wood deer, do it first. My wife, please, ask your villagers to build fires and bring out plenty of bowls of milk beer, and we will have a celebration in honor of this man who, no matter what, cannot tell a lie."
Thanks. Thank you. One of my favorite African stories. I'd like you to imagine, since we're exploring the notion, can language, or does language, illuminate or obscure? I'll take a moment to reflect upon that story. Mamadi, using a great many subjunctive cases, qualifiers, and ifs, and potentialies, and whatnot, was able to deliver his message with perfect clarity and never, never say a single thing. And it's always interesting to look at our politicians at work. I feel often I'm listening to the very same sort of obscurantist language. And it all seems so substantial and workable and sensible until one listens in and finds that truly there is absolutely nothing there, much like the emperor having no clothes. I'd like you to do a thought experiment with me. We're standing in a circle, 50 of us. We're blindfolded. And in between us is some unknown object. And it is our job, without touching it, walking toward it, or seeing it to identify this unknown object. Luckily, we have been given, each of us, a supply of cosmic basketballs. These basketballs resemble an ordinary basketball, and you have an unlimited supply of them. Except that when you throw this basketball, of course, being a basketball, it will bounce back directly toward you. It will not lose any height because of the work of gravity upon it. If you throw it directly at a flat object, it will come back directly at you and bump your nose exactly at the same level at which it was thrown. If you, of course, threw it with your nose. If you threw it from above your head, if there's nothing there, it will simply sail off into infinity and it will simply never come back. If you throw it at foot level and it bounces back, you will know that there is some material there in the darkness at foot level. There are 50 of us. We have surrounded this unknown object, and we begin to pelt it with our cosmic basketballs. We are also allowed to trade notes with one another, to say, oh, my bounced back, and it was about 5 feet tall. And you say, well, mine bounced back, and it was just at 1 inch. And others could say, well, I threw mine up 10 feet high, and it just sailed clearly off into infinity. And so the process of pelting the unknown object begins with our cosmic basketballs. You can imagine it. It would be a very funny sight. It would look somewhat like mayhem. But we would begin slowly trading notes to say, well, I think over here, next to where you are and where I am, it seems to be about 3 feet high. And then others would say, well, I think I detected a surface and it was oblique because I threw the ball and it bounced back this way. And then others would say, well, so on and so forth and so on and so forth. And so after some time of having the basketballs bounce back at us, we end up discovering that it is an SUV. We're still blindfolded, however, but we've discovered that, you know, the top of the windows of the SUV bounce the balls back here, and the tires there, and the rear gate there, but the trunk or the hood is very different. It's lower than everything else, and slowly we have figured out, roughly speaking, that we have ourselves an SUV. But then comes the tough question. What brand? Is it a Mercedes? No, well, perhaps it is. Is it a Ford? Is it one of those interesting-looking Audis? What is it? So we go back to where we suspect the emblem might be, and whether it's those four little circles or the VW or the Ford oval or whatever, we're bouncing our basketball against it. And no matter how many times and how many angles we do, the emblem is much too small for us to get any information from our cosmic basketballs, no matter how many times we bounce them. So someone perhaps gives us cosmic marshmallows or cosmic grains of sand, perhaps. Something that is small enough so that it can get inside those little insignias and tell us the brand name. The reason I bring that up, because, you know, how many of you have ever, in your education, sat before a microscope? Okay. You know, and they're wonderful, wonderful things. Van Leeuwenhoek and his fabulous discovery of the microorganisms inside water. You know, it was just such an opener of human perception. You can have a compound microscope, which will do 50 times, 100 times, 200 times, you know. And you have a light source. It either comes up through the base plate or it shines down upon what it is you're looking at. The best a light microscope can do in examining small things is about 2,000 magnifications. Think of a light microscope as using cosmic basketballs. Scientists have been vexed by this question of resolution for a long time. And then someone came up with a scanning electron microscope, and suddenly the resolution went down to a million times. And unbelievable visions of small things, of crystalline structures, of the long hairs of ants, of all manner of things that really could never, ever have been seen before, with this stream of much smaller electrons bouncing off it, were made visible. And we could do the same thing with this room. I'm going to do a cosmic basketball treatment of this room. This room is big. Thank you. Now I'm going to try to do a different sort of treatment of this room using slightly higher resolution of language. Well, this room looks to be about, 100 feet across by 100 feet deep. It has beautiful rafters, and up in the rafters, almost obscured by the stage lights, at least from the stage, are a few round arcs of structural material. The seats are red, and I do hope they're comfortable, but I can't claim that because I haven't sat in one yet. And there's a delightful gentleman off to everyone's left who's just chuckled a second ago. And there are banners behind the presenter, and there are banners behind the audience up on the balcony as well. And it's a nice sunny day. Some of the curtains are open, and some of them are not. Much higher resolution using language, the second pass around. The reason I bring all this up is because I've always been interested in human language. That's my profession. I talk. And you as audience members, hopefully listen. How many of you, I'll ask you a question, as you listen to that funny story from the Soninke people, found yourself seeing images in your mind's eye? How many of you sort of saw the characters in the village? That kind of mental imagery is basically how I learn to tell stories. I look at the mental images and then report what it is that I see in the mind's eye, much the way I just reported to you what I saw with my physical eye. And in the learning of doing that, I came across some interesting ideas. Did you know that in the third trimester of gestation, babies floating in mom's ocean will respond whenever they hear the 50-some-odd phonemes of language? They will physically twitch in a discreet manner. Phonemes, pa and eh, and m and p and u and r, those are the phonemes, the little tiny chunks that we so fluidly assemble into spoken language. And we fairly fluidly assemble into written language as well. And what they're doing is they are listening and wiring their neural nets for language to come. So in the third trimester, they are already listening. So if mom and dad are outside, if they're arguing, baby hears it. If they're laughing, baby hears it. If they're whispering, baby hears it. It's very, very interesting. And the scientists noted, these were studies were done back in the 70s, that the babies would twitch in a certain way as each phoneme was heard and reacted to. And their nerves would myelinate and the networks would build and whatnot in the brain. Very interesting stuff. And those phonemes and the resolution that language gave us had a profound shift at one point. Imagine that, first of all, we are in the Pleistocene epoch. It's 25,000 years ago. We are living with furs. We are very cold. We're perhaps Paleo-Siberian peoples, but nevertheless, we're communicating. We use utterances. Who knows what those ancient languages were like, and how many utterances coded for various things in their world? But at one point, long ago in the Indo-European times, two people said the word mon. And both of them, in their mind's eyes, they didn't even have to be beneath the moon. They both imagined, just as you imagine the village and the river and everything, they imagined the moon. And it was that birth of symbolic thought that must have revolutionized the human experience, along with tool building and all the other things, but just that coding of that word that came to be called month and moon and everything else back in those days must have been a revelation that you could talk about something in the abstract for the first time. One of the first jobs I got after I graduated from college was as a tour director for Tauk Tours. Tauk Tours left the Waldorf Astoria in Manhattan, and we journeyed from Manhattan with a busload of people, and I was the young guy in the front with the green jacket and the microphone, all the way down through the Valley of Virginia to Gatlinburg, Tennessee, and back.
And one of the things I wanted to do was study wildflowers because I didn't know very much about them. I had always walked along sidewalks and paths and seen sort of this undifferentiated green stuff. Just as I had before I learned to identify trees, would look up and just see undifferentiated green things. But once I discovered, I began to learn their names and what identified them as an individual species, I began to see them. They began to lift forward out of that undifferentiated green stuff and appear as individual species. And I felt as if the world were being created before my eyes. And I said to myself, wow, this must have been what happened to ancient people. In the beginning, there was the Word. Almost across many, many traditions, sacred traditions, if you're talking about the origin of things, the deity speaks and the world is created. This is almost a pan-human perception. And so I think that may well reflect early human beings beginning to name the world around them. And as they did, the world really did almost seem to be created. Does that make sense? Yeah, that struck me as a curious, possible reality. Think of when language that had, pardon me, been spoken completely up until a certain time, about 5,000 years ago, began to be written. What a revolution to be able to somehow, mostly with pictures. If you look at the Egyptian hieroglyphs, for instance, that's a pictorial language. They're not using an alphabet. They're using symbolic pictures and arranging them, and it was indeed an inscrutable language until the Rosetta Stone was discovered by Napoleon when he was in, and his men brought it to him. They were invading Egypt at the time. The Rosetta Stone, of course, had, I believe it was Greek, Aramaic, and ancient hieroglyphic Egyptian, all coding for the same text, and the ancient secret of hieroglyphs was broken. But at some point, someone invented the alphabet, that which codes for what it is we exactly speak. So I'm going to offer a new word. I've never said this word before. I'm going to, this is an aguinonadzo. Okay? I've never said that word. Aguinonadzo. Aguino. That's A-G-U-I. Aguino. N-O-D-Z-O. Now, aguinonadzos are the architectural spaces that surround everything in this room at the distance of exactly 1 inch. So look at your neighbor. Can you see his or her aguinonadzo? It's right there. It covers them completely. It's perfect in its mapping of their outer contours. They're all in the frames of the windows, along the lights. They're just about everywhere if you really start looking for them. And so we have this interesting ability, we human beings, to dream up something and pronounce it, even if it's a ridiculous word, and then write it out. I mean, they're doing this in the computer field every day. They're generating hundreds of words every day. And they all make sense, and they all do something. I mean, 20 years ago, download, hard drive, flash drive, teraflops. Talk to the most brilliant scientist in the world in the Second World War, Alan Turing himself, someone like that. What are teraflops? He wouldn't be able to tell you. He'd say, Tara, what's that? Is that a trillion? I'm sure a scientist is in here. Flops, floating, operations per second. What is that? This was before, UNIAC, the big computer that was half the size of this room with vacuum bulbs. I think it was called UNIAC, was it? UNIVAC. Thank you. That was that first grand computer flipping its gates open and closed and thinking so fast. I need to read you something.
Studies have been done called ERP studies. And these are called event-related potential studies. So potential in when brain scientists are measuring or examining and measuring brain activity just means electrical impulses. They're electrical potentials, but it just means impulses. And they have found that watching people look at color, if I flashed you a piece of green within 10 milliseconds, 10 thousandths of a second, you would say green, or you would see green. But 200 milliseconds, another 190 milliseconds later, the word green appears in one's mind. These are such small differences that we feel as if we instantaneously say, oh, green, green, and the word floats in. But all these wonders are stored all across our brain, and there really are different times when they come in. Now, if you were given, and the way people have discovered this is that they'll give you a test. A psychologist will say, please, come sit. Now, I'm going to show you a page. And on the page will be the word G-R-E-E-N, and one of them will be spelled out in green letters. But then you'll have R-E-D, but it will be spelled out in blue letters. And then you'll have G-R-E-E-N, but it'll be spelled out in red letters. And what they will do is they will have you, as quickly as you can, tell them the color that you see. But it's a mad scramble when part of your mind is saying green, but meanwhile your sensory eye is saying, oh no, that's blue. And they've been able to tease apart how quickly you react by befuddling you with these words that are the wrong color. Has anyone had an experience with language recently or in your life that convinced you that it was just wholly inadequate? Sir. Yes, that difference between looking at the sky and then finding the word to try to describe it. Who else has one of those sorts of things? Ma'am. She does shamanistic work, and there is no way to describe any of it. Yes, adequately. Sir?
Describing smells, tastes, describe how a flower smells. It's very amusing, I find, to hear wine editors talk about
a pile of words. Wine editor, that's funny. Yes, sir. Wonderful. Yes.
Somebody asked me how to explain playing peek.
Sir.
The point where numbers become unimaginable, like there are 5 quintillion stars in the universe. You can't remind them of 5 quintillion.
5 quintillion. Yes. Yes. Tricky, tricky. Yes.
The
word no does not mean no when used in Israel. In what way? Could you give us an example?
Yes, like when you say no, you can't buy that. It does not in any way mean no.
Great. Any other examples of the complete inadequacy of language?
Yes.
So that really works. Singing therapy for children who stutter. I didn't know that. Yes, yes. I remember my third son went through a period of that, and my wife and I looked at one another and said, we will do nothing. We will say nothing. And it went away fairly quickly after that. Any other anecdotes about the impossibility of describing nature with these words, no matter how many words we pile upon one another? A great pile of words. Yes. Well, I'd give him a round of applause if I were you. The question is one that we, of course, could mull over and go back and forth, across and under and around for hours and hours. It is quite adequate for certain purposes, and I think your illustration, sir, of the how to describe the sky is just a perfect example of how impossible it is for certain things that we perceive, such as that green on the page, to be matched by the languages that we have. Sir.
It seems like when you try to describe something indescribable, you throw verbal basketballs at it from different angles. Oh, I think I get what you mean.
Yes, verbal basketballs. And we do have this wonderful metaphoric ability and an imagination capability. And so putting those two together, we actually are able to do what those two people in the cave did and say, mourn, and see the moon together. Yes?
We saw a comedian once who brought up describing people's skin color. You know, we say white, black, whatever, and he's like, that's skin adequate. And so he suggested going to the paint store and finding color that matches your skin complexion. And he said he was Rudolph Brown.
I had a professor in at college who called most Caucasians swine pink. I think I fit well within that category. Yeah. Any other ones? Yes. Her thought was that when language proves inadequate, we go to music or we go to art or something else that allows us to communicate in yet another way. Sir. I've had in my talkback sessions spontaneous discoveries of storytellers already. Just yesterday, very fine examples of spoken stories that are beginning to take place. It's really exciting. Yes. But no utterances, but the outer apparatus of her attempt to speak. Wow, yes. It's amazing. Yes. Yes.
Part of
Indeed so. I mean, if you think, to close up our conversation, if you think of what probably went by us in third or fourth grade and we weren't particularly interested in it, otherwise known as the parts of speech. Think of what the parts of speech are. Well, you've got nouns, so it's like a mapping system. The nouns tell us what it is we're looking at. The verbs tell us what we're looking at, what they are doing. And the prepositions, which are the most wonderful, tell us what, how they are interacting between one another. Conjunctions, they're not so impressive, but prepositions are really neat. There she stood, blank him. Choose your preposition. Above, astride. Beneath. If she's an octopus, she could have been around him. Who knows? She is ambiguous. But nevertheless, as you leave today, take a look around this beautiful campus and say, what part of speech is that? That's a tree. No, that's a hickory. No, that's a paulownia tree with the long beans. Now, what is that? And then see if there's not some action upon it, if the wind isn't blowing through it. And just take a look at your daily language for about an hour and watch yourself knit together this glorious map and attempt to describe the indescribable, as you so eloquently put it, which is an impossible task. Tomorrow, good people, I'm going to conclude my series of presentations with a look at, do we have free will or not? So thank you for being here again. Have a good day.